Blog Talk Radio.
Consultants and attorneys often featured on the popular news programs for families of violent crime to find answers and seek justice. The Crime Wire team, Vito Colucci Jr., private investigator and author, Denny Griffin, retired investigator and author, Tom Shamshak, former police chief, private investigator and instructor at Boston University, and Susan Murphy Milano, violence expert and author, are there on top of the crime at the top of their game. Crime Wire is the place for information, news, safety, and most importantly, justice. Our interactive website is www.crimewiresite.com. You can call in anytime during the show. The number is 1-646-478-0982. And remember, you can participate in tonight's show simply by going to the live interactive chat room here on Blog Talk Radio. If you are a friend or family member and would like to send the Crime Wire team information about an unsolved or suspicious death case, or want to be considered for a segment on a case for a future show, email us at thecrimewire@gmail.com. Susan and Denny have the night off. Again, welcome to Crime Wire. I'm Tom Shamshak. Tonight's co-host is Vito Colucci Jr. Vito, good evening.
Good evening, Tom. Welcome, everybody, to our show. As what everybody's doing in the country, we're going to start off talking a little bit now about the Casey Anthony murder trial. And unless you're living on Mars, you know about this sensational trial. And it's amazing. The verdict is in. The jury has spoken. Casey Anthony was found not guilty in the death of her 2-year-old daughter, Kaylee Anthony. And tonight we're going to review the trial and analyze the outcome. Very interesting case. I have found this an interesting case. It's one of those cases where after a few days, I started watching it on either Fox News or some of the different channels, True TV or whatever, and it was very addictive. It had all the elements on this case, and it was amazing. Tom, why don't you give us your overview a little bit on what you think on this case? What happened? Where do you think everybody stands right now, Tom?
Well, Vito, here's my assessment. I thought, based on my observation of the trial, that there was sufficient proof to prove beyond a reasonable doubt that Casey Anthony was responsible for her daughter's death. Now, the jury obviously didn't see it that way. I, along with a number of other individuals, including Nancy Grace, Judge Alex, and a host of other people, agree that there was that the case was proved. And but you know, we have to accept the jury's decision. And what's interesting is to hear the various jurors coming forward now talking about their buyer's remorse, if you will. They're a little concerned about the impact of the sentence. And again, I think that this young woman walked away from a murder.
Well, you know, Tom, I did some research on some different things across the country just because I did obviously, like everybody did, TV shows and radio shows about this as it was going on. And because, you know, going online and reading people's comments, you know, I read quite a few times about people saying, that's it, I'm going to leave the country. Now, you know, they're not going to do that. But still, for somebody to say, that's it, I'm getting out of this country, the whole bit. I did research, and what the listeners need to understand, first of all, and this comes from all crime statistics, 95% of criminal trials wind up with a conviction. So I'm going to say that again so everybody can understand that. 95% of criminal trials wind up with a conviction. So it's very few times 5% where, you know, the person is found not guilty. Defense attorneys, and I work a lot of times for the families, and then sometimes I work for the defense attorneys. Defense attorneys have a lot of work to do on cases. So to say, well, our criminal justice system stinks, and I'm going to move away to Canada or someplace else, I wouldn't advise that, because I think you'd be very foolish, because we still have the best justice system in the world. 12 jurors and even the four alternates that spoke on television all said, 16 people now have said, well, you know, we didn't really feel the prosecution provided us with enough information, this and that. So, you know, people, you got one juror now that has moved away, death threats. And I'll be very honest with you, I'll be very blunt with you. People doing that are stupid people. To threaten somebody that took 2 months out of their life to work on a jury, tried to make the decision that was presented to them, and now getting death threats, defense attorneys getting death threats, Casey Anthony getting death threats. You know, it's. I think that is a sorry commentary on everything, Tom, you know?
It is. I agree. That's despicable. It's not in keeping with, you know, the accepting the fact that the jury has spoken and you have to move forward. And, you know, now let's kind of analyze what did they see that differed from what we saw? I mean, I thought that there was, again, ample testimonial evidence, the lying, the repeated lying of Casey Anthony. Again, and maybe this is my bias, and I know, you know, Vito, you share this bias because, you know, we're both mm-hmm. former cops.
Right.
And, you know, we see the world a little differently. We're skeptical. We're cynical. What mother, after a child goes missing, hides that fact from family and friends for 31 days with repeated lies? And then when the body is suddenly discovered, the scenario changes. No longer is the child missing and with a nanny who took the child by force. Now the child has succumbed to an accidental drowning, and let's blame dad. I know the defense has a job to do, and I think they put up a case that, well, you know, that they didn't have to, but they certainly vilified that family, particularly the father.
Well, what I think they did, Tom, I wasn't a big fan of Baez. As I was watching the case, I was thinking to myself, well, you know, I've sat front row at the biggest trials of the last couple of decades. And to me, I was sitting there saying, wow, where is he going with this swimming pool? And the father did it and this and that, all this kind of stuff. And then he began his closing argument. And up to the point in the closing argument where he went back, why, I don't know, where he went back to the swimming pool and this and that, I thought up to that point he gave a brilliant closing argument. Why? Because what he did, he put the magnetic pictures up on the board of almost every prosecution witness, especially the forensic people, and said, how about this one? And then he brought up, he knew from discovery, all the people that the prosecutors spoke to before the trial that they didn't bring to court. So what did Baez do? He brought them to court, okay? And he was able to offset some of those things. Do I think Casey is very much involved in this whole thing? Of course. Of course I do. But the bottom line is you do have to prove it. I think they went a little bit too far with trying to prove the duct tape and this and that when you have no cause of death. Okay? Now, I said this on a show the other day, and I mean this wholeheartedly. I took a bold step, and I said, if I'm the investigator on this case, either for the prosecution's office or a private detective hired by the family, I would have found that body a lot sooner. This is a body that's right around the corner from the house, a wooded area, 19 feet away from the street. 19 feet. That's three people's length. So you know how close that is. Because when I do a case, I would have been there with somebody, other people from my office, and I don't care that there was a lot of water there. I don't care about the hurricane or a monsoon. You go and you you hunt through that place. And another cop would have found out that this was a burial place, or this was a place that Casey Anthony would have liked to go for many times throughout the years. So maybe finding the body quite a bit earlier would have changed things. And I know that's a bold move, but that's just what I would have done. That's the closest part. Now, if it was something miles away, I can't stand here and say, oh, I would have went to that place. But I definitely would have checked what was the closest thing around the corner and done a little more work, especially after the poor soul, Kronk, calls the police department and gives them those first couple informations, Tom.
Yeah, well, that was very troubling. And as we know, an officer was disciplined. He was actually terminated for his incompetence in dealing with that aspect of the case. I think another area that the jury may have relied on was the testimony of Dr. Werner Spitz. Now, I thought that Jose Baez very effectively was able to draw out from the government's witnesses that they had indeed read the textbooks authored by Dr. Spitz. What's your take on that?
Yep. Oh, definitely. I said this on a show the other day. Okay, Werner Spitz. Now, you know, I watch the TV channels and I listen to the people calling in the TV channels, all making fun of this old guy. Okay, well, he should retire. What does he know? He looks like an idiot up there. See, again, you being a former police chief and me being somebody that's worked these cases just like you, the guy is a legend. Those prosecution witnesses had to read his textbooks to get where they are. Okay, he's worked on the cases of John F. Kennedy and Martin Luther King. So now if you're the prosecution, what you do with this guy to cross-examine him, you go up there, you try to throw a couple things out. You don't go against him. You just try to get some other things there, throw it out. And then what you do, and I use a scenario of a baseball game. The All-Star game is on right now as we're talking. What you do with him is you intentionally walk him, which means you get him out of there as quickly as possible. You know,
yep.
You don't go after a man like that. I don't care if he's 127 years old. You do some token questions. You try to get a little thing to help you if you're the prosecution and get him off the stand. You know, so I think that was a mistake right there.
I agree. What do you think of the job of the prosecutor, in particular, Ashton and Burdick? I thought they did a commendable job. I wonder if the outbreak of the mirthful laughter in the closing by Jose Baez was a distraction that was held against the prosecution. What are your thoughts on that?
Oh, yeah, I had Holly Hughes on my national syndicated radio show yesterday. And Holly Hughes, who, you know, as you know, covered this whole trial daily, all right, she said that was disgusting what he did. You are taught in law school the greatness of a trial, the magnitude of the trial, and how you honor a trial, okay, and how you go with a professionalism. You just don't do that. You know, and also,
yeah.
You know what I found, too, again, like you, working a lot of these cases, I watch jurors all the time when I'm sitting front row on these big cases. And I had a feeling that, and I didn't say, you know, Ashton or I think they did a good job. I just didn't like some of their attitude sometimes because jurors pick up on that. You know, now Baez, like I said, I'm not a big fan of his. But he came out with a big smile to, hey, how's everybody doing today, that type of a thing. And like I think one juror said on one of the show, he came across likable. Okay, now, you know, you're there to do your business and you shouldn't have to be likable or a friend to the jury. But people pick up on that, Tom. People pick up on that, too. They don't like somebody that talks down to people and talks really bad, you know, to a Spitz or to somebody else and gets an attitude and things of that nature. So, you know, you have to carry yourself a certain way. You know, it's too bad. That was his last trial. He retired. It's terrible to go out that way with the biggest, you know, he did a lot of great things in his career, Ashton, but to go out after 35 years or whatever it was, and, you know, because I know how that works on those cases that you lose. You know, you see, he could be sitting on a boat 5 years from now fishing and it'll come to mind. or he'll wake up in the middle of the night and wonder what else he could have done. It's just the way it goes, because I always say, whether you're an ex-cop or whether you're a private detective, in your career, there's that one case that didn't go the way you thought it should go. And, you know, that's his case.
Vito, let me hold you right there. We've got a caller. Let me see who this caller is. We were expecting somebody. Hello?
Hey, Tom, it's Bob Ward. How are you?
Hey, Bob, let me introduce you to our listeners across the country. Vito, we're about to be joined by investigative reporter Bob Ward from Boston's Fox 25. Bob and I have collaborated on a number of local cases. He is a well-known authority, works with local law enforcement, private investigators. He has a program called New England's Unsolved that is featured weekly on Saturday nights, and what he does is he works with local law enforcement and features cold cases. And Bob has been following the Casey Anthony trial. And Bob, tell our listeners, what's your take on it?
Well, my take is that from what I was able to follow in the press and what I was able to watch on live television, as much as I could, I wasn't in the courtroom. I was up here in Boston. But to me, it seems that justice was not served for that little baby, that this mother, Casey Anthony, in my mind, got away with murder.
That's exactly what I said earlier. Vito?
Oh, yeah. I mean, without a doubt, justice was not served. What we're doing is just trying to give some possible reasons as three people here, that yourself and me and Tom, of people that maybe know a little bit more about this type of stuff than the average person that just turns on the television that just says, let's hang her now. Let's not even do a trial. Let's just go hang her. And you know, again, like I opened the show by saying, 95% of criminal trials end with a conviction. So we still have a very good justice system. This one went horribly wrong, okay? And there's probably many, many reasons for that. But you can't point the finger at 16 people up there, including the alternates. Or, I mean, it's a combination of different things that they didn't feel was proved, you know?
You know, I was distressed last night when I was watching on Fox News Channel, Greta Van Susteren was interviewing the foreman of the jury. And, you know, I'm anxious to see part two, which I won't get to see until later tonight. We have the All-Star game on, and I'm working tonight. But, you know, the thing that bothered me is when she was asking this juror, the foreman of the jury, about different aspects of the case, whether it was the chloroform, the searches on the internet, or some other thing like that, and she would say, "So, do you think that the mother actually, you know, looked that up on the computer?" And his answer was always the same. Well, that's disputed, and it seemed to me that his position was that if Jose Baez had an alternate was questioning something, then it went into the category of the disputed, and the jury felt that it couldn't decide for itself where the truth was, which is what the jury is supposed to do. And that really distressed me. It just seemed like they could not bring it upon themselves to make decisions. And that's what they're there to do.
Yeah.
Yeah, you know, too, and also, and a couple people have brought this up, your trials start and end with the picking of the jury.
Yes.
Okay? So,
yes.
You know, the prosecution picked and the defense picked who you wanted. So they picked 16 people, let's say probably split in half, using your things to get people off of there. So that's an equal picking. I've worked with many jury consultants. A lot of lawyers do not believe in them, do not use them. But when you have a case of this nature, those kind of people really delve into a lot of things about the subject and what type of area you're dealing with and the mindset of a lot of people. So, I mean, there's a lot of things. I mean, we could sit here and pick out probably 20 different Monday morning quarterback what-ifs, mm-hmm. you know?
Yeah, absolutely. The thing, though, that just has me scratching my head is the 10 hours that they took to look at this case, and there wasn't a single person on that jury like us who would stand there after 10 hours and say, you know what, though? I know what you're saying about reasonable doubt, you don't feel comfortable about X, Y, and Z, but here's the big picture, you know, and then that person doesn't stick to their guns of, you know, she killed the kid, If she needs to be held accountable for it. Maybe not murder one. I totally understand why they didn't feel comfortable with murder one. But the lesser charges that would have seen her do substantial jail time, that's what I don't understand. That there wasn't one person who could last longer than 10 hours, I just don't understand. And it makes me think that when they left that courtroom to begin their deliberations, they were already leaning towards acquittal. And I sat through much of that, especially those closing statements by the prosecution, which I thought were very powerful, connected all the dots. If you had any questions, it really was kind of a roadmap right through this and made perfect sense. Yet they went completely the other way, and that's why I was so shocked by this. If they had acquitted her, when did they get the case? On a Monday? If they had acquitted her on Friday after 4 days of deliberation, all right, I think it would be easier to understand. But to come back in 10 hours and let her go, that to me is the one thing that really I have a hard time getting my hands around. And I totally understand where people say, this jury needed everything. It's not like the Scott Peterson jury, which had no problem. They didn't know, when Lacey Peterson was killed, where she was killed, or how she was killed. They just knew she was dead and she was murdered, and they convicted him. They had no problem with a circumstantial case, but this jury did.
Yeah, I mean, this one really went against the grain, because the rule of thumb all the time is the longer the jury is out, the better it is for the defense.
Right. Right.
After the closing arguments, my wife asked me what I thought, as well as TV shows, and I said they're going to get her on count three, aggravated manslaughter.
Yep.
And I said from months ago, I told Levi Page and everybody, there's no way they're going to give her the death penalty. I said they're just not going to do it no matter what. Okay?
Right.
And that's how I felt. Okay. So now, they give the not guilty verdict for count one. I figured that when I sat back. Surprise, now on count two, I'm saying, okay, all right, well, maybe they're just going to do the count three. Maybe the jury said, well, we got to get her on something big, put her away for a long time. Then when they said, now, get not guilty on that, I had a little brain freeze for a minute. I said, well, wait a minute. The other stuff is nothing.
Exactly.
After 35 years of doing this stuff, I sat there and said, there's nothing left. Those are minor charges.
Yeah.
I said, holy cow. But I thought she would be convicted on count three and get a long sentence for that.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think people would be comfortable with that, because then that would address the issue that, of some of the evidence that was called into question. The jury must have, they mistook reasonable doubt for all doubt, and they needed it spelled out for them.
That's a good point. Again, going back to Holly Hughes, who did my nationwide show yesterday, she brought up a good point as a former top prosecutor. She said she felt that the prosecution and the judge should have explained better direct evidence compared to circumstantial evidence.
Mm-hmm.
And I brought up a point. I said when I was working the Michael Scacco, Martha Moxley trial, I remember the judge at the end doing a simple thing that a lot of the lawyers, and Holly told me yesterday, they learned in law school. He did a simple illustration to the jury. He said to them, let me explain to you what circumstantial evidence is. I put a bowl of milk on my kitchen table. I have a cat laying on the floor. I step out of the room for 2 minutes to do something. I come back, the milk is gone, and the cat is licking its lips. I did not see the cat drink that, but that's circumstantial evidence. And see, sometimes the simpler the better with a jury, because I said to Holly after she said that, I said, I remember looking at the jurors, and they're all nodding their head in the trials I work, because they understood that point. You go to bed at night, there's no snow on the ground. It's totally, you wake up in the morning, there's a foot of snow. Did you see it snow? No, but the snow is there. That's circumstantial evidence. And like I said, sometimes, like Holly said too, make it simpler. You go into a long thing where they go back to the jury room, and I've seen this before, where they go, I'm totally confused.
Sure.
I don't know. And that's a good point you brought up,
And Linda Drane Burdick, the way she ended the prosecution's case by asking that simple question, whose life is improved with Kaylee's death, and ended with those photographs, the tattoo and Casey Anthony dancing, side by side, she said, that's your answer right there. That, I thought that was a home run. I thought that was nailing the door shut. It really put it into perspective and made you second guess what Jose Baez's points were in closing. Now, closing obviously is not evidence, but it helps you over a long trial like that try to keep it together and remember what the salient points are. I just thought she just hit it out of the park with that, and it was a great and powerful thing to end on, and they obviously were not thinking along those lines.
Yeah, I mean, obviously, they were shocked. Go ahead, Tom.
No, I just say, and Bob and I that morning had exchanged emails about, how devastating that closing was, particularly for me with the comparison of the behavioral responses of grief and guilt. I thought that Linda, the female prosecutor, Burke, did a tremendous job with detailing that and comparing and contrasting. But
and the other simple statement too, Tom, when they said no one has an accident and makes it look like it's a murder. It's always the
other
way around. I mean, such simple things to remember and to take into that jury room. And that's what I mean. I don't understand with those thoughts in their heads as they went to begin the deliberations, that was not a more persuasive argument. Really surprising to me.
Well, yeah, I wonder if in the future we'll have more experts working with the prosecution in selecting jurors.
Could very well be. And then also they were sequestered for such a long time. You know, maybe they just felt they'd heard enough. They just wanted to get out of there. I don't know.
Yeah. Well, listen, Bob's going to have to be running. We're getting close to the end of our segment. But Vito, I'd like to invite Bob back again. He's now laser focused on a national story, the recent arrest of Whitey Bulger, Bulger of South Boston.
Yeah.
Bob has been at the Moakley Courthouse. Bob's been following this from the get-go, and this is a story that CNN is going to be doing a primetime show on. And so hopefully at some point in the future, Bob, if you could get permission from your unit to let you come back and
Absolutely.
Share some of your perspectives on that.
Absolutely. I it would be my pleasure.
All right.
Thank you, Bob.
Thanks, guys.
This is a great commentary. Thank you very much.
Oh, thank you. And likewise, thank you so much, guys. I'll talk to you later.
Thanks, Bob.
Take care. Bye-bye.
All right. Bye-bye.
Hey, Tom?
Yes, sir.
People were talking about, like, especially a lot of prosecutors didn't like Baez the way he handled himself. And, you know, it was a little bit unethical, they felt, and things like that, which is probably true. I brought up the illustration. I said, going back to the first O.J. case, okay, with Johnny Cochran, many people felt that was, you know, unethical how he handled himself on that, but what he did on that was, it was amazing, because it was kind of like a win at all cost type of thing, okay? But I know, like, what he did on that, he got into what's called a cadence that you would hear a lot of times, let's say in a black church with the pastor, you know, a certain type of a cadence he got into at near the end of it, and he stirred up the jury enough, okay, where they came back with a not guilty verdict. So, I mean, you know, whether we liked it or not at the time, as a defense attorney, throwing caution to the wind, he came out with that. Baez came out with his own thing. He had his own thing to say. I mean, and whether Ashton was laughing at him a couple times there, he probably couldn't believe how maybe stupid he felt Baez was, or he's telling lies up there. But the bottom line is that it won. And it's unfortunate, you know?
Yep. All right, well, listen, that kind of concludes our first segment. And let's segue into our next segment. Perhaps we could have our next guest even give us a little information on their thoughts on the Casey Anthony trial. Tonight it is my pleasure to introduce two new CrimeWire consultants. Dean and Karen Beers join us on the CrimeWire team. Now, Dean and Karen Beers live in the great state of Colorado and operate their private investigation firm, Forensic Investigators of Colorado. This husband and wife team are expert consultants and legal investigators of personal injury, negligence, and death. Tonight, Dean and Karen are going to share their professional background with our listeners across the country and tell us about their experience as specialists in the very specialized field of death investigation. Dean and Karen, good evening and welcome to CrimeWire. Dean?
Good evening, Tom. How
are you?
I'm good, Tom. How are you doing?
All right. Is Karen there with you?
I think she's trying to call in, yeah.
Okay, all right. Well, let's start with you. This is your opportunity to plug yourself, so make sure you give your firm's contact information, website. This is a free advertisement. But let's start with tell us about you and Karen, and tell us how you got into this specialty of death investigation.
Sure, Tom, and Karen should be with us. Well, I started in the private investigation field in 1987, and Karen joined me in 96. In general background in legal investigation, civil and criminal cases. In 2000, we had a life-changing event because of getting hit by a drunk driver and going through rehabilitation. It was a decision I had to make to continue the business or move on to something else because of difficulties. And in the course of all that, I found myself in training here at the local medical examiner's office and started that in September of 2002, completed that, which is a long story of how that training is, but it's a very hands-on scene work, autopsy work. It's the whole thing. It's a very unusual environment. And during my part-time work, I continued trying to do some private investigative work. And then I was hired full-time, offered a job, and decided to accept that. And during that time, Karen also started the training program and then started working part-time. So we worked there together doing the autopsies, the crime scenes, the incident scenes, and the complete investigation, evidence collection. And then in 2008, she left that office, and I believe it was about 2006, and in 2008 I left and returned to the private sector. And we both had a commitment based on her education and experience and my business experience that we would continue helping families through these traumatic experiences that they have, and mostly concentrate on some personal injury, but mostly death cases. So we do that, of course, in Colorado, but we actually do more consulting nationwide with a variety of other investigators and law firms in civil and criminal cases.
Okay. Before we get into that, I know that you're involved with your state association and you belong to several national PI organizations. Tell us about that.
Yeah. In Colorado, we have the Professional Private Investigators Association of Colorado. I'm the past vice president of membership and current chairman of the board. And I'd like to throw out there that first we have voluntary licensing in Colorado that will take effect next year for the first time in 34 years. So we finally got that passed also, thanks with your help and many others. I'm the Region 5A Director for the National Council of Investigation and Security Services. I serve on that board with you and several other fine people. And I'm also a member of the National Association of Legal Investigators, and I serve on the Certified Legal Investigator Committee for that. And I'm also one of the few, if not I think the only, private sector investigator still working death investigations that's also a member of the National Association of Medical Examiners as an affiliate investigator, because I consult with forensic pathologists, Karen and I do, that are members of NAME, and we maintain that relationship with them.
Okay. And I understand that you have published a number of articles, as well as two books, and thank you for signing your most recent book. Would you tell us a little about that?
You're welcome, Tom. A lot of people know I've been busy writing quite a few things. Karen's, we're looking forward to seeing her first article published here in PI Magazine upcoming. I won't tell anybody what that's about, but I'm looking forward to it. I will say that it's definitely focused on what our listeners would be interested in, by the way, death investigation and autopsy issues. So I've written for several magazines online and in print. My most recent book is Practical Methods for Legal Investigations from CRC Press that was released this last February, and it focuses on a methodical method of conducting and completing an investigation, whether it be in the civil sector or the criminal sector, of our legal investigative work. And there's also some information in there about some death investigation protocols and things like that.
Can we have your better half jump in here and speak to us?
Yeah,
hello,
I think she was
I am
here.
Good evening, Karen. You're here with
Hi,
Vito.
Hi, Tom. How are you?
I'm well, and here's my partner, Vito Colucci.
How you doing, folks?
Hello.
Hello. Didn't I meet you one time quite a while ago at the PI convention?
In Las Vegas?
I don't know.
Yeah, 2005.
Was it in Vegas?
2005 at the PI. I was one of the speakers then. I think I met you, but I could be wrong.
2005, I'll jump in. We were at the medical examiner's office and didn't attend any conventions.
Oh, okay. Okay.
So I guess not.
I guess not. Okay. There was somebody else from Colorado I had met. I thought it was you guys. But this is very interesting, Dean. I love hearing about your background and your specialties and everything else. And here's my question, because there's not a lot of husband and wife investigators across the country. My wife has helped me over the 23 years with my business, office-wise, background checks, things like that. But how is it to work as a husband and wife together? Let's go into that.
Okay. Do you want to answer?
Nobody wants to say anything.
Well,
I've done a lot of talking.
For us, it's easy. You know, we just happen to work well together.
Sure.
I bring him, I use my different senses when we're doing a case, and so both of us together just kind of make things work.
Right. Yeah, I tell you, having women investigators that have worked for me over the years, it's amazing what I learn from their insight. They pick up, sometimes I have solved a case in a matter of a couple hours that maybe would have taken a man, you know, much longer a time period. I mean, with their women's intuition and just different things like, I have a feeling she's going to do this type of a thing. And before you know it, these women have been right. And it's amazing. And it's just incredible, not only their expertise and their background and everything else, but just what they bring to the table. You know, a woman sitting in a car on a surveillance with a newspaper open, like she's looking, and a for sale sign on some of the houses that are nearby, it's not going to get bothered too much. You have one male or two males together in a car, you're going to draw the attention. People are going to be calling the police. A man and a woman sitting in a car, I have found that to work out really good, because they look like a couple sitting across the street from this house with a for sale sign on it. So, you know, it's so many things that it helps you with, from the bad old days many, many years ago, where it was just a guy trying to hide in a car someplace, you know?
Hey, Vito.
Exactly.
Karen. We got a caller here who'd like to say hello to both of you.
Good evening, everybody. Hey. This is the New York Denny Griffin, the other Denny Griffin tonight here, and I wanted to say hello to everybody and welcome Dean and Karen. Thank you very much for
To you.
Being on.
Hi, Denny.
Denny was an investigator before any of us was investigators. Hey. Many, 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 many years ago. And I don't want to say he's an older gentleman, but his social security his social security number is 7.
Keep that in mind. It's 7.
It's 7.
I was
That's
an investigator.
His social security number.
I was an investigator before they had investigators.
That's right.
You know, I had a little technical problem trying to get through. I tried to call on the first segment also, and I couldn't get through. But, man, oh, man, I really enjoyed the conversation, and I was all fired up again, you know, with doing a recap of that whole mess. And some of the conversation I heard, you know, I'm at a loss to explain how the jury did this. They got through this thing so quickly, to have gone through each and every death-related charge and never asked a question, never asked the judge for clarification. Like, it was like they weren't even considering.
That's right. They didn't even want to read back, Denny, on anything.
Yeah.
They didn't ask anything.
I was totally... maybe amazed is the word, stunned, shocked, whatever, surprised at least, when they came back. And I was like you, Vito. I was listening, you know, murder one I had doubts about because of everybody been talking about the death penalty. And the jurors, even though that was only the guilt phase, the jurors might not want to take a chance on even getting that on the table. So when they said not guilty there, I wasn't totally surprised. I figured all along at least manslaughter, though. I said they gotta, you know, I figured a compromise verdict. And there was no compromise.
Yep.
I mean, there was nothing to compromise, apparently. It was just, and I really had trouble with that. And I've had trouble with, you know, trying to justify how they came to that conclusion. I realize that this is our system and all that kind of stuff. I'm not questioning that. I know the verdict is what it is, and we have to live with it. But I still think there's something wrong there. And I was wondering, too, we were talking... I've been talking on several different venues since the verdict about whether the CSI thing era has anything to do with this. Are we at the point that any doubt is reasonable doubt? I mean, do people so much expect there to be every single I dotted and T crossed that if there's any circumstantial piece at all that hasn't clearly been resolved by scientific evidence, then that means reasonable doubt. I don't know if that's what happened, but I'm trying to think of different reasons they could have taken what I consider to be not reasonable doubt and made it all reasonable.
Let's ask our medical legal experts here.
Dean, Karen,
what are your thoughts on it?
Well,
yeah,
I have heard almost
about
every word that just came out of Denny's mouth. I absolutely, to me, this has just been unbelievable and very disappointing. And I agree. I know this is our system, but, you know, to just lay down and say, okay, hey, this is the way it goes, when it is so clear cut to me, this was one of the most frustrating cases I've ever seen.
Yeah, and we even removed our experiences from this and just tried to go with, you know, out throwing in our own experiences and not developing theories like the jury, I think, left with. And Karen's experiences with, you know, she has the social work experience and education and juveniles and stuff. So she's able to put in a lot of different insight that I didn't consider. And no matter how you look at it, there was still enough evidence there, in my opinion, that reasonable doubt wasn't the issue. But I think now, as Danny said and Karen said, and we've talked about in the first segment, you know, it's now turned into, I have no doubt in my mind, or the other way around. And we don't have a system of no doubt in my mind. As parents, we never talk to our kids and say, I have no doubt in my mind. You know, we still look at everything and make a judgment based on that reasonable doubt. And I think this whole thing of direct evidence and circumstantial evidence, which, you know, good examples were given earlier, has caused a problem, you know, the CSI effect, which even in, you know, and Karen can jump on this too, even with sitting down with family notifications, which of every part of that job was the most difficult, telling somebody that their 14-year-old daughter wouldn't come home because her 16-year-old boyfriend was driving drunk and killed her. You know, they go through all the emotions within minutes, and then, you know, later they want to know, well, are you sure? Because I've seen on TV that this is what could have happened. And you have to explain to them that TV is just not reality. Of course, we have to do it differently, but that's what you explain. And that's what we do in the private sector. And that's actually Karen's really strong point, is really getting in there with them and empathizing with, you know, where they're at and where they've been.
Dean, let me just follow up with that. So tell us about your client base and walk us through the nature of your investigative methodology and what is it at the end result that you present to your client, whether it's a lawyer or, you know, family?
Sure. I do pattern injury analysis as well. So that's a different segment and some consultations that I do, especially with criminal defense attorneys. But we actually primarily get our cases from other attorneys, other investigators, which may be working with the families or another or an attorney client of theirs. And, you know, we get the case, and Karen and I typically review it. I mean, we may review it at dinner, breakfast, or whatever the case may be. And then we actually start looking at it the same way as we did our medical examiner days, where we'd look at the reports and the scene information and the evidence are given in that, and we look at the autopsy information and even go so far as, you know, figuring out where the injuries were, what corresponded with the reports, the witness statements, and the evidence, and just start looking to see if there's Well, I guess we can use that reasonable doubt thing. In medicine, it's actually a preponderance, but we really look at it. Is it strong enough to say that, for example, if somebody has a gunshot wound or maybe a ligature strangulation, is there evidence there that's strong enough to say that it was homicide versus suicide or accident versus suicide or something like that? Because these things can become so important as to determine heredity for estates or insurances, such as double indemnity for accidents. So those are some of the cases that we tend to see more and more of from around the country and stuff from our colleagues, our other investigative colleagues and stuff. And then we'll work through that. Karen might be handling one component of it and I another, and we put it together, or depending on the case, we may just work the whole thing. And then we always just kind of sit down and go through it and read each other's reports and talk about it. So we really work as a team well that way.
And then you give your report to whom? To the investigator or to the attorney? How does that work?
The bottom line, whoever's paying the bill, whoever retained us, most of the time it's actually the investigators that we're asked to work with, except for in the criminal cases, and it's the attorney for the most part.
Okay, so now you and I are working on a case out of state that we really can't talk about, but just using that, you're right now you're reporting directly to the investigator who brought us both in.
Correct, yeah.
And then what we're working on is a suspicious suicide that, from our analysis, from my examination of interviews with a wife of a dead husband, I see a lot of mistakes made by the responding officers and then the subsequent detective follow-up interviews. And Dean has been looking at the injuries, been looking at the autopsy photographs, and we're just trying to put all this together. And the goal of this particular case is to get the local law enforcement to change the determination from suicide to, Dean, what would it be, a suspicious death, or can you, comment on maybe cause and manner?
Yeah, as it's looking, as I gave it, we're only working on the death component, Karen and I, on that one. We're not looking at the investigative component. There are some cases we get involved in the whole thing, but this one we're just doing the equivocal death component, which equivocal just means that question. And the injuries and stuff, and in fact on a few of those, that's one of those things where we look at the pictures and look at the reports and the diagrams and just kind of get some information in our heads and talk about it, and then we go back and really do an in-depth review. And on this particular one, Karen caught on a couple of things that were actually fairly significant that I reported to our colleague as far as it makes a big difference that wasn't noticed before from my conversations with our colleague. So we're, that's definitely something that becomes important.
All right. Now, going forward, you and Karen have offered and we graciously accept your service as consultants to the Crime Wire team. How do you see your skills augmenting what the CrimeWire team, and specifically CrimeWire Investigation Bureau, is going to work toward? How do you see your skills helping us?
Go ahead, Karen.
Well, as I would say, the more minds that work together, the better results you're going to get, except in the case of these 12 jurors that we just saw. But other than that, usually, one person may have one great idea, but then it's the other set of eyes that will bring the other component into it. And I do like what Vito said about women's intuition. Because now there are some men that have good intuition, but when I look at something, I use my intelligence, and I'm blessed with common sense as well, and I use my intuition and my gut. Now, some people put that in one basket, so to speak, but intuition comes from the head, and then your gut is, of course, your body sense. But all of that, I think, bring great things to the table.
Mm-hmm. All right. And Dean?
I have to agree with that, yeah. And that's why we work together so well. You know, her, I mean, her intuition was one of those important things on several cases, actually. You know, hands back a report that I took a lot of time to write and says, well, when I was looking at this, this is, you know, something you didn't mention. Well, that's because maybe I wasn't, I mean, I'm just honest about it. I just wasn't thinking about it from that perspective. So it's very important, and it is. And I think I'm looking forward to, you know, helping the team out, the families out, and seeing if we can't at least work on bringing some answers forward to their families because, you know, deaths are traumatic beyond my own personal belief. And we feel like we have the skills and the knowledge, along with the rest of the team, to help put something together and start bringing some, you know, adding something to the works.
Hey, well, Tom? Thank you. Yes, go ahead, Vito.
Tom, an interesting point they brought up about having different eyes look at a case. I had interns for about 9 years in my office from a top university, all seniors, tops of their class in criminal justice, 3.8, 3.9, grade point averages, things of that nature. And it would be amazing when I would give them a very, very big, thick file on a case, maybe even something current that I was working on. And after doing this for 35 years, sometimes you get a little, not an attitude, but you kind of think like, okay, well we've, geez, Tom's a former police chief. We have this couple on the phone that have done great work. Now here you get these 20-year-old kids that have said, well, Vito, here's what I think's going on, and here's the reason why, blah, 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 blah. And I would look at them in amazement. And these are the same people that went on to Homeland Security. I've met with the FBI when they wanted to talk to me about these subjects, police departments, everything. And it's incredible what they bring to the table. And so, like Karen said, I think it's different eyes and ears are amazing to just talk to and learn from, you know?
Yep, yep, yep. Danny, you got a question for them?
Yeah, just well, I guess it's more of a comment. I'm totally on board with what's been said about the extra eyes and the extra opinions because, well, look, I mean, look at these cold case squads in police agencies and civilian type cold case people. They get the fresh eyes on these things. And it's amazing what somebody taking a fresh look at things can come up with that maybe the people that have had it under their noses for so long have missed or just don't see. And I think having assembling people like Dean and Karen and our other consultants and the team itself is really going to be a benefit to those families that are looking for some type of answer. And a lot of the families, I believe, even if their theory that perhaps their loved one did not commit suicide or did not die by accident, I think even if the answer they get is that, well, after looking at all the information available and you know, and getting professional opinions, it's very likely that in fact this was a suicide. I think even that answer, even though it may be not what they thought, at least it's some type of resolution. I don't want to use closure. It's when you lose a loved one like that. I don't know if there's ever really a closure, but at least a resolution to try to get that mystery piece of it out of the way is what happened to my loved one. So I think, you know, the intent, and if we can, as a team, bring answers or resolution to some of these families, then I think that's a heck of a good thing.
Can I throw a question out, Tom, to Dean and Karen? What I have seen, first of all, when I was a detective on the police department handling cases, let's say it was something that kind of showed it could possibly have been a suicide rather than a murder or something, some other reason. I know my lieutenant, my captain, even if I went to them and said, okay, this appears to be this, well, go back, Vito, do more work, do more interviews, talk to all the people that knew this subject. Yeah, but the gun's right next to him on the floor. Nobody else is there. I don't care. Go back and do more work. I think sometimes nowadays, and the police do a great job across the country, but one thing I have seen now, being an ex-cop, is a lot of times they will rush to judgment a lot more quicker than in my day. And the unfortunate part of that is because then the police and the medical examiner says to the family, well, you know, right now I'm calling it a suicide, but if you obtain any more information, bring it back to us and we'll look into it. Now, that sounds all right, but the problem with that is, first of all, what do you mean find more information? That means I got to go probably hire a private detective, pay out a lot of money, or do investigation myself, or do this and do that. It's very difficult a lot of times to have that case reopened. And what do you guys feel about that, Karen?
Well,
a lot of times there's a rush
exactly,
to judgment on this.
Yeah, the rush to judgment is something, you know, we're in a hurry. Everybody's in a hurry. And even investigators on scene, they're always in a hurry. But the rushing to judgment, and then, like you said, if you obtain more information, well, that just messes with the heads of the families. You know, it's like, wait, you mean it could be something else, which creates another whole other problem. But, yeah, I agree. There is too much rushing.
Here's what I'd like to say to that, and that's a very good question. As Voltaire said, to the living we owe respect and to the dead we owe the truth. Karen and I particularly find ourselves have always said we're the voices for the decedents, you know. I mean, if I go take pictures at a funeral home or somebody that was beaten pretty badly, you know, I wasn't hired by that family to, you know, go back and tell them, you know, this is what I found, but, you know, I don't have time to finish this right now. So if you get more information, let me know, and then we'll start working on your case a little better. I mean, that's in the private side, but even at the ME's office, Karen and I both, we were the eyes and ears for the pathologist. We were trained so well that our pathologist did not expect to get called out to the scene. They expected us to report to them exactly what we saw and collected. We were very entrusted and extremely well trained. I mean, we could do another show just on how much training is involved in this whole process. But we did see that with some law enforcement, not with everybody, but with some. And we considered it basically an aberration to we would never tell a family, I or our colleagues, you know, by the way, this is how we're going to do it. In fact, we would spend weeks and months. I had a wood chipper case. I've had hunter fatality cases. I've had child deaths and Karen too, where, you know, we said, this is going to take us some time. We're going to be spending a lot of time on this. We don't have an answer for you right now because we're going to give you the best answer we can basically one time. And that was our goal, so to speak, was to give them that resolution, as Danny put it. It might take several weeks, but we weren't going to go back and change it. I had to do that one time in my career, and it was devastating to me, where a pathologist changed an opinion after what I still think was bad information was given to him, but I had to go back and tell the family that death certificate was changed. And it's devastating to the family and me as the investigator. And I don't think it's right to do that.
Well, Dean, thank you for sharing that with us. Listen, before we wrap up, tell our audience how to get in touch with you guys.
They can get in touch with us. Our website is forensic-investigators.com. Our phone number is 888-281-6912. It's answered by either Karen or I all the time. You can also reach us by email. Karen's is Beers, KS, at forensic-investigators.com, and mine is Beers, DA, at forensic-investigators.com. And we're glad to, consult and work on cases from all over the country, and, of course, now with Crime Wire, and we really appreciate you having us on board and look forward to it.
All right, and again, we'll try to get your website and your monthly newsletter up and posted on the Crime Wire site so people can check that out.
Okay.
Appreciate it. Yeah, we put out a monthly newsletter. You bet. Thanks.
All right.
Thank you so much for having us on here.
It's a pleasure. Thank you both for joining us. Let me turn it over to Vito.
Okay, great show tonight. Thanks to Dean and Karen Beers for joining us tonight and enlightening our listeners about the specialty of death investigations. On behalf of the entire CrimeWire team, it is my pleasure to welcome both of you as CrimeWire consultants. We and our listeners across the country look forward to your input and commentary in connection with future cases that come to CrimeWire. Thanks also to the CrimeWire team, our Director of Research, Double K, Kim Colton, the fabulous Kim Colton, and the whole public relations teams at Imagine Publicity. Our next show will be on Tuesday, July 19th. Tune in as we continue to analyze cases and crimes that wreak havoc on families looking for answers and seeking justice.
Thank you for joining us tonight on CrimeWire. We always welcome your support and value you as our guests. If you would like your case to be featured on CrimeWire, email us at thecrimewire@gmail.com. To hear a rebroadcast of tonight's show, go to www.crimewire.blogspot.com. Turn on the volume at your computer and the show will automatically play.
Remember, we ensure that your voices will be heard when there is nowhere else to turn. Visit our website at www.crimewiresite.com. Good night and God bless from the CrimeWire team, Vito Colucci Jr., Denny Griffith, Tom Shanshack, and Susan Murphy Milano. Thank you and good night.
Good night, Vito.
Good night, Tom.